everyone, and welcome. This is episode 319 of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast, part of the MKE Tailgate Network. I'm James, back this week, joined again, as always, Ryan and Paul here. We're doing this on a Super Bowl hangover Monday because obviously we were a little busy on Sunday. So how are you guys holding up? Paul, you know, your voice is going to be tested a little bit here. Yeah.
Yes, it is a work in progress, but it is getting slightly better as time goes on. And the Super Bowl did not do it any favors, of course. But
a little bit of yelling at the TV.
You know, I didn't care that much, but when people start to mismanage clocks and then that gets me to yell at the TV a little bit. Yes. So a little bit of that. Minipod was okay. We hit the punters over. That was good.
Nice. Probably hit it early too, with the way that first half went. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Not perfect, because Mahomes actually threw an interception and Purdy didn't, which huge upset. I was not expecting that, but that's okay. The outcome was what we expected it to be, which is all you can really count on.
Yeah, Purdy definitely tried.
He did try. He really wanted that interception, and they just wouldn't give it to him.
No, it is a wild finish, a very late finish, as I still work for a CBS affiliate, and the late news went on very, very, very late. But yeah, it's at least an entertaining finish to the game, even if Tony Romo ruined Nance's call at the end. But, you know, that'll happen. Ryan, how are you?
I'm doing great. It's fantastic.
Yeah,
We did some electrical work yesterday outside, so that was good.
And you're still alive.
Yeah, didn't die
after doing much work.
My wife did say
plus on the electrical work.
Yeah, yeah. She's like, you know what? Before we actually like turn this on and do this, we should probably before we start, you know, doing anything with the wiring itself, we should probably just, you know, turn off the breakers. I'm like, yeah, but the power's off. She's like, no. We're turning off the breakers. So,
what would you do without her?
That's what that electrical engineering degree is for.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I missed a little bit last week since the last time I was on. Still plenty to talk about in terms of, you know, the Corbin Burns, you know, reactions to that trade and what they got back. We have some questions about that. And the Brewers turned around and made some more maybe confounding moves, if you want to describe it that way, after trading Corbin Burns. They turned around and spent that money elsewhere. So we'll talk about that interesting juxtaposition.
We've all been saying they needed another catcher on this podcast. And
yeah.
No, wait a minute. That is not what we've been saying at all. That was
no.
All right, we'll get to that.
No, yeah, we will. Reminder, you get question priority on this podcast. Going to patreon.com/MKETailgate, signing up for $2 a month. That will guarantee you that question priority, both on this podcast and on reporting as eligible. $5 gets you that perk, plus the additional exclusive podcast. That includes the Minor League Extra with Ryan and James Anderson from RotoWire. If you haven't listened to Ryan's interview with Ben Badler yet, go and do that. That was a week or two ago now. I still haven't listened to it, so shame on me for that. But a perk to go and listen to that if you haven't already. Even if you're not a patron, as always, you can support us another way. Go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening to this right now. Give us a 5-star review and hit that follow button, as well as tell your friends about us as we approach spring training here. So, as you guys alluded to at the top there, couple of notable big league signings this week. First, they added swingman Jacob Junis to the rotation. Woo! Feel the excitement there. And then signing Gary Sanchez to back up William Contreras at catcher. Probably play some DH. We've got a number of questions about Gary Sanchez, so I guess let's just start there on Patreon. Ian Pomplin asking here, Gary Sanchez, low batting average last year, but would have had the fourth highest OPS plus on the team and would have tied for the highest number of home runs. Is he going to hit dingers, or are we looking at another signing of a player past his prime? So, Paul, I know you were kind of puzzled, to say the least, about this signing. How do you feel?
It's weird. I feel like we have a lot of catchers, and Gary Sanchez is a weird fit. Now the catchers can stay in the minors, I guess, which is fine. But Gary Sanchez is fine. I think the thing. So in discussing Gary Sanchez, I don't pay attention to the Yankees very much at all, and American League Baseball generally at all. And so I was sort of aware of the existence of Gary Sanchez, but unaware of his profile as a defensive butcher. Not profile, his reputation.
Reputation.
Mm-hmm. Reputation.
Yeah, more fair. Yeah.
As a defensive butcher. And really just thought of him as a kind of guy that doesn't hit very well, but must be good at catching because he keeps catching. Turned out that's not the case at all. He is renowned for his bat and thought to be bad at defense, but turns out not that bad at defense by most metrics. They vary between average and slightly above average, even kind of well above average. And so he's, you know, for a catcher, hits okay, I think is the thing with Gary Sanchez, which is fine. But, you know, as a backup catcher, fine. Kind of an expensive backup catcher, in my opinion, but whatever. Maybe they try and move him around slash use him as a DH, but, like, his bat's not good for a DH. It's just good for a catcher. So, I don't know. It's fine. It's a very Brewer move. I don't think it does very much in particular. I would have rather they spent $7 million on someone slightly better at a different position, but is what it is. Not excited. Don't really care. And maybe they'll do something fun with him, but I hope he hits. I don't care about anything else.
Yeah, I think that there's a pretty decent chance he does hit. And we talked about this coming into the offseason, and what we both said was the main thing this team lacked last year was power. They had kind of a lot of the other stuff. By the end of the year, their on-base percentage was almost league average.
Yep,
so they'd gotten back up to that point, but they were still down in that bottom part of the league in terms of home run power. They were just not a team that hit the ball hard very well at all. And that did show up in those two playoff games where they are out-homered 4-1, of course, by a team that actually basically hit for the same amount of power they did in the regular season. But whatever, I mean, it did show up there that, like, they didn't have much power. It wasn't a very powerful lineup, and they needed to improve that. And I think Sanchez is a big part of this. The guy in 267 plate appearances last year hit 19 dingers, and that was playing in Petco. So, for the most part, anyway, like, that's, you know, his main home park last year was Petco. There was a brief dalliance elsewhere. I don't even remember exactly where that was, but
he was a Met for a cup of coffee.
Yeah, for like a hot second.
It was very bad DFA'd immediately. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And so that kind of power, and this is what the questioner was alluding to, is kind of a big thing they needed. And add that to Rhys Hoskins, you're kind of ticking off, like, the biggest needs this offense had coming into the year. You've added a substantial amount of, you know, I guess on paper, like, close to 50 home runs here. Granted, you're losing what you had from Rowdy and from Carlos Santana and Mark Canna and those guys. So those kind of offset each other. But then you're also getting presumably more from the younger guys as well than maybe what they gave last year. So I think they did add power to this lineup, and that was the number one need that they had. So offensively, I was flabbergasted. I was talking to Derek Van Riper from The Athletic about this a little bit. We were talking on Twitter about it. I just, like, I cannot believe I had been led astray all these years about Gary Sanchez supposedly being a butcher.
Same.
And looking at FanGraphs,
media, man.
Yeah, 37.8 above average. I mean, this is, like, really, really good numbers. Now, if you look at the Baseball Prospectus numbers, Paul, you kind of alluded to this, the BP numbers are much closer to average. He was just like 3 or 4 runs better than average there. But yeah, this was quite eye-opening. And now that I think about it, I feel like Ben Lindbergh has talked about this some on Effectively Wild, that, like, his reputation as a passed ball merchant, as a guy who can't catch, that is very much a New York media thing. And it really isn't backed up by the cold, hard numbers that are out there. So, I think this is fine. It's just money. This is another one of those situations, much like the Hoskins
thing.
This is just money. It's Mark's money, not mine. And we all want him to spend it. So just fine. Go spend it on this. It's fine. Worst case scenario here is he's bad and he gets released, and who cares? There are a number of best case scenarios where he's integral in, you know, a surprisingly good Brewers team this year, or he has a season that's fine, but the team doesn't, and he gets traded at the deadline and you get something for him. So those things are fine.
To nip a few things in the bud that I'm sure will come up in popular speak about Gary Sanchez, we have a reputation as a franchise of taking catchers who are butchers and turning them into defensive stars.
Right.
That probably won't happen here for two reasons. One of which is he's not a huge butcher to start with. Mm-hmm. And second, it's harder to teach older catchers like good framing and things like that. Framing is a young man's game. People do tend to get worse at it over time. There are exceptions like Yadi, but generally speaking, as you get into your 30s, which he is, you're probably not going to see a huge uptick. Maybe some, you know, they're good at coaching this, but not a lot. So he's not going to, like, I'm guessing he'll be represented as a catcher who wasn't that good at defense and that the Brewers can improve. And that's probably not the case there. The other thing is he doesn't have huge platoon splits. They're not reverse, but they're pretty even Stevens. So that's okay with your catcher because you want your backup catcher to play when your first catcher is, you know, tired, needs a break, not as a situational guy. That's actually probably better than having a big platoon split catcher, to be honest. But worth keeping in mind, if he's going to play off of catcher, you can't just load him up against opposite side hitting and get like great production. Yeah, good production, but there's not like a huge advantage that he brings. So
yeah, that's for his career. He did hammer lefties last year.
Oh, did he? Okay.
A smallish sample. Yeah. I mean, there was a big gap in what he did last year. He really did hammer lefties, but we're talking a sample here that's too small to draw any firm conclusions. But it is just worth mentioning. Because that does happen sometimes. As guys get older, as hitters start to develop the old man skills, sometimes they do become opposite hand pitching mashers where they get to see the ball for a longer time out of the pitcher's hand and they just sort of start to be able to do that in a way that maybe once the bat starts to slow down a little bit, it is kind of an old man skill.
Totally. Worth noting, 2 years ago, had reverse platoon splits, was worse against lefties. So.
There you go. All right. Adam Post, our next Gary Sanchez question on Patreon asking, this season, will Gary Sanchez start more games at catcher or at DH? So, Paul, you kind of mentioned he's suitable as a backup catcher to step in when you need Contreras to take a day off or be the DH. But I guess just how interchangeable are those two in those roles?
Contreras is better at catching. I guess it's the long and short of it. He's better defensively. The bat plays much better. And, you know, DH is a high offense position. Catcher is not. Not that you get the same hitting either way, but you want Contreras catching if he can catch because he provides more value there. Sanchez, like we said, is not terrible there, but you give something up defensively when he's hitting there. I bet that Sanchez will probably, I would bet he out DHs his catching. I think he'll actually use him there kind of a lot. He has a good profile for it. He's done it a lot. It has been a regular Sanchez occurrence to do a decent amount of DHing over the course of his career. Not a huge amount, but, and honestly, just looking at their team profile, he's going to be one of the better offensive choices for DH, which is not as much praise for Sanchez as it is an indictment of the rest of the Brewer team. So there's right. that too.
Yeah, so I was going to kind of go that direction with you and say more DH than catching. Yeah. But I think that what's actually going to happen here is it's going to mean that that William Contreras DHs more. Just to keep mm-hmm. him fresh. I think you're going to see Sanchez step in and catch more than he maybe otherwise would. And that's going to mean more Contreras at the DH. The other thing that kind of changed my mind on this was I was reading the interview with Pat Murphy in the JS by Todd Rosiak. And he kind of said something about that sort of hinted along the lines of, yeah, they have a lot of outfielders. But hey, Christian Yelich can DH. And maybe that helps him, you know, to stay healthy and fresh a little bit more. So I think we're going to see Christian Yelich at DH a lot, especially early in the season. We already kind of talked about that on the pod, like as this was a way to get those young outfielders more playing time, to get mm-hmm. Yelich at the DH more and to spread the playing time around more for those young guys, at least at the start of the season. And so I think that's kind of the direction it's going to go. But I think you're going to see a lot of the catcher at DH on this team. Like the catcher who isn't starting, the other one's going to be at DH, I think, kind of a lot. Yeah. If not as much as Yelich overall, but quite a bit.
That might lead into our next question or pair of questions, really. I'm going to take these two together. Lucre's Suitcase and Steve S. asking sort of similar questions, or at least under the same umbrella. So first, Lucre's Suitcase asking, how do you see the catcher logjam working out this year now that they have four under contract and Caro in the wings? And then Steve S. asking, the Sanchez signing gives them four eligible catchers on their 40-man, as Caro is also on there. In regards to Eric Haas, who is on a one-year major league contract, does he A, spend the entire year in the majors, minus IL stance, real or phantom? B, get DFA'd or traded after the All-Star break? C, make the opening day roster, but get DFA'd or traded before the All-Star break? D, get DFA'd, traded before opening day? Or E, something else I didn't think of? So yeah, four catchers on the 40-man now once that Gary Sanchez is added, and that doesn't account for the other Nola brother also being a non-roster invitee to spring training as well. Yep. So, you know, you talk about maybe splitting a lot of catcher DH between Sanchez and Contreras. Is there a possibility maybe like a third catcher makes their way onto the 26-man roster on opening day? Ryan, you're shaking your head though.
No, I really don't see it. And I think that mostly Eric Haas was an emergency situation. It was they got him on a price that they liked fairly early in the winter, and they clearly still were interested in doing other things. I'm sure they had their eye on Gary Sanchez, didn't think they'd probably get him, but here we are. They ended up with him. So yeah, I really don't think, looking at this, Eric Haas has a one-year, $1 million contract. Now, that's guaranteed, so they're going to have to pay that money, but that's really not the kind of money that you'd worry about losing, and there's a pretty good chance that if he doesn't accept like being DFA'd and being sent out of camp, like assuming both of the top two catchers come out of camp healthy and everything, because if there's an injury, then that totally changes the equation here. But I think it's going to be on him whether or not he wants to accept being sent down to the minors out of camp, or if he wants to stay in the Brewers organization. Gonna check what is his option situation. That would be a good thing to know.
I was trying to pull that up. He's been around for a while, but not in the majors for a while.
Yeah, he's gotten a little bit of time here and there, but he doesn't have any options, so they wouldn't be able to send him down. As far as like him having to be like DFA'd and sent out to go to the minors, I think that's what would have to happen. So it'd be a question of, does he want to stay with the organization and be their third catcher, or is some other opportunity opened up? Does somebody else want him coming out of camp? I think there's a pretty good chance he ends up on another team coming out of camp. I guess that would be my right. Probably most likely scenario here, is he ends up on another team coming out of camp.
Yeah. Haas is gone. He's a worse version of Sanchez. And so there's no reason to have him around.
100%. Right. Right. And it's not even like he would be starting in AAA and be the first call up, right? Because you have to assume Caro's starting at AAA. So probably not a lot of opportunity there now for him. All right. Moving over to Jacob Junis. He was a true swingman for the Giants last year, started only 4 out of the 40 games he pitched, but he faced double-digit batters in 18 of those games. He also finished 6 games and picked up a save, so proven closer, Jacob Junis. The contract is for $7 million, but $3 million of that is deferred to 2025. You know, talking about the signing, Matt Arnold said he's been successful in both roles, starting at relief, and they saw an uptick in his arsenal last year with the Giants. No surprise, given their reputation there. He's willing to do both and just wants to come in and help us win, Matt Arnold said. Just his ability to function in both those roles, we think, has a lot of value. So obviously, you know, especially after trading Corbin Burnes, the Brewers need to fill a lot of innings, because as we've discussed, it's not just Corbin Burnes they're replacing, it's Brandon Woodruff's innings as well, right? So I guess, Paul, what are your expectations for Jacob Junis this year? He definitely had a lot of success throwing that slider in San Francisco, but I guess where do you see him fitting in?
I think that they will probably slate him for kind of what he did last year, for extended inning middle relief. I think that they're probably taking a look at everybody who can potentially start just to see what's there. And Junis does fit that profile. But I think he'll probably be like a long bullpen guy and an important cog in terms of, you know, with Burns gone, starters are probably not going to get out of the fifth or sixth very much this year. So they need one or two guys like this to carry the middle innings. They just do. And that's what this is going to be, because that's what his deal is. That slider uptick is real. After joining the Giants, it skyrocketed from 40% of his arsenal to 60% of his arsenal, which is great because sliders are awesome, but they also do a number on your arm, so worth keeping an eye on that as well. But he is an effective middle relief guy. He'll probably pitch a ton of innings for us as long as he's healthy. And I think probably not as a starter, but I wouldn't even be surprised if they get another Junis-like guy before camp starts for the same reason.
Yeah, that slider is one of the best pitches in baseball. Eno Saris has talked about that it's truly a bastard pitch. It's really, really tough on hitters. And he was throwing it like 65% of the time with the Giants by the end of last year. So
yeah, it's a lot of slider.
It's a lot of slider. That's a lot of torque on the elbow. This is a one-year deal, though, so that's really not our problem. there's that. Also, they are legit here when they talk about his fastball velocity. He had been a guy who sat in the 91 mile an hour range for fastball velocity. He gets to San Francisco and it ticks up to 92 in his first year there, and then ticked to 94 last year. So there has been a legit uptick in the stuff. So I think in terms of usage in this whole situation, again, to go back to that Pat Murphy interview, which I'm really glad now I read today during my lunchtime, he sounded very out-getter-ish about not just Junis, but in general, and made a comment like, it may not be the most popular things with people, but it's really how we want to do things here, meaning deploying guys in maybe some ways that are unconventional. Now, I think that I those stats that I talked about, because I went and looked at his game by game stats, and yeah, 18 of those 40 games he faced double digit batters, but that was really largely between like 12 and 18, and 18 was where he maxed out. He never faced more than 18, so exactly two times through the order was the absolute maximum. I would like to see them maybe try to push that just a little bit, maybe more up to a point where he is just a little bit more than that. Because if you can do that, then you can start doing some really interesting things with him, like deploying an opener. Now, I know that, so oddly, in the Craig Council era, we didn't really do the opener thing. You'd think we would have done the opener thing a lot more. We did it only a few times, and it didn't usually work great. People kind of got annoyed about it. There was a really bad Trevor McGill outing. But trust me when I say a lot of teams do this and it works pretty well. And one of the wonderful things about it is if you deploy a fairly decent reliever, not great, but a fairly decent reliever in that first inning and get through the top of that order once, what you can do then is have your starter potentially go, you know, 20, 21, 22 batters before they have to face the top of the order again. For a second time. So they can avoid potentially the first batters in the order before they have to face them. Or I'm sorry. No. My math on that is wrong. They would have to go through, you get into the high teens before they would have to do that again. So you can avoid having to face that group, for a third time. You can get up into like the 23, 24, 25 before they would have to face those guys a third time. That's what I meant to say. Sorry. My mental math here is bad late on a Monday night. Anyway, there is some real value to it and some ways that you could deploy him. The question is, I think, mostly going to be physical. How does he hold up to it? Does he hold his velocity? Is he able to throw sharp breaking sliders that much that deep into games? And is that going to work, or are we going to see, you know, a degradation there? So, he's very, very interesting. This is a fascinating signing for a lot of reasons. And I think kind of more of an indicator of if they hadn't for all those years had so many good, you know, had the troika of Burns, Woodruff, and Peralta at the top of the order, it kind of meant they didn't have to do a bunch of other stuff. Add in guys like Adrian Hauser and, over time, like these other guys. they haven't had to do things like Junis, and I think this is kind of almost like them going into a very comfortable place where they're going to be doing this, and I think are going to be able to squeeze a lot of value out of, if not Jacob Junis, guys like Jacob Junis in the future. Yep.
Yeah, it does sort of feel like a return to the 2018, 2019, 27 outs mentality as opposed to just leaning on the big horses, right? And Junis, if he can give you, you know, he was at 80-some innings. If you can get 80 to 100 decent to above average innings out of him, you know, it goes a long way. So we'll see where it fits in.
86 last year. If you could get the 112 that he did in 2022, granted that was with a higher ERA, like a half a point higher, that is maybe pushing it, but they got more value out of him. And actually some of the expected numbers, the xFIP, the FIPs were actually just fine. I think he got a little unlucky in 2022 and maybe a little luckier in 2023, though the strikeout rate did spike. Also, one other thing, you love to see that strikeout minus walk ratio for him. He really, he's got a K minus BB percent of 20.4% that last year. That's really something you
I'll
like
take
to see.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't walk people. He does get strikeouts. Yeah. He's going to have times when he gives up home runs. It's just going to be part of the deal, but yeah, maybe there might be a chance they avoid pitching him at home somewhat and try to, you know, shade him more towards road starts where it's not quite as home run friendly an environment, but we'll see.
The Dave Bush route. Love that. All right. before we get to more Patreon questions, we did want to mention too a couple of new projections, or at least playoff odds, out now. And I think this is super interesting to me because it's sort of aside from just the first set of playoff odds that we were getting this offseason, it represents sort of like a rerun of the Pecota and Zips standings post Burns trade. So it kind of gives us a quick and dirty way to kind of evaluate to just how much those projection systems think the Brewers lost there. So Pecota now projecting the Brewers under 500, 79.4 wins, and playoff odds of 28.3%. So that tells you what the NL wildcard race looks like. Fangraphs a little bit more optimistic, up to 81.1 wins in their latest run of Zips projections there. Playoff odds at 35.1%. You know, both of those roughly, I think, around third place in the division in terms of division odds. Those numbers also all pretty low compared to recent seasons that we've gotten used to. You guys have talked about that as well. I guess, are they too low, or are the Brewers kind of really headed to a, I don't know if you want to call it a down season, but a temper your expectations and anything above 500 is gravy season. Paul, what do you think?
I don't think they're too low. They lost Woodruff for good and they lost Burns, and that's a huge win difference. And to point out, it's not like they're going from those two to a zero war replacement. That's not the case, you know, but the pitchers that likely will end up replacing them in the aggregate, meaning, you know, the actual fourth and fifth starters to get booted up, fifth and sixth, whatever, plus the extra relief, is going to be more like 1.5, or in all likelihood, than the 3.5 to 4 you get out of those guys. So that's a big dent. It just is. I think council, like prospectus in particular, does keep track of your manager's contributions to your winning. And they thought the world of council, and they're going to an unknown manager. They will likely keep up a lot of the same strategies, but there's a lot of personality and you know, actual managing built into council as a person too. So you can't just project them to be the best at this anymore. Can't do it. They lost a couple of their key offensive contributors from last year. Guys who weren't particularly good, but Mark Canna was like one of the best offensive players on the team last year for the time he was there. Mm-hmm. He's not there anymore. Churio's young. So I think these are legitimate projections. If you want to pick over them, I think that's fine, because I think their likely variance is very high. However, I think they used to have a really high floor just based on playing good defense, having good pitching, and having very good managing. And I think that floor is now much, much, much lower just based on a much more fragile pitching staff, an unknown manager and a bunch of young guys who may not hit. So I will probably be right on that number slash maybe even a little under it. I think they're kind of due for some regression that way too. But yeah, I think that's legit. It makes perfect sense.
Yeah, I was going to bring out that Baseball Prospectus had a kind of a long tail on their high end, so that there was like this, you could see at the very end when they do that graph that shows like what the shape of their yep. win totals is.
Yeah, they had a camel, which is weird.
Yeah, they do. Double well, they yeah. still do kind of, but they used to have in the first running of this, they had a very long tail on the high end where it was like, actually their high end tail was basically equal with like the Cardinals high end tail. Like their high end was about equal to where they were and was well ahead of what the Cubs high end tail was. That's not there anymore. I wonder what happened. They're always adjusting these things and rerunning numbers. Yep. I don't know what would have caused that, but whatever, that isn't there anymore. But yeah, I think the error bars around this team, it's actually kind of surprising because it doesn't look like they have as big of error bars as even like the Cardinals do. And that's in kind of both directions from the center point. So I'm wondering what kind of is going on there. I think to me, this team obviously has some seriously big error bars, especially I think on the high end. I think this team can do some things on the high end if these young talented players turn out to be better, faster than we sort of would expect them to be. That would be something that could really drive it. So I will say that for that positive side of things, but man, I don't feel like these are drastically off. I don't think that putting kind of a midpoint, I guess more like in the Fangraphs range of right around 500, I don't think that's out of line. I think that's perfectly reasonable. I know that what they're doing is trying to build through depth, and normally in the past, Pecota has recognized that and given them the boost for building through depth that way. And they're not this year, and I think that should be a pause. And I don't know how much of it, like you said, is the Craig Council thing. I think, yeah, the biggest difference and the biggest question I have there is, besides the completely unquantifiable man management stuff, like the interactions with players and all the players, you know, you have Colton Wong literally saying he would run through a brick wall for Craig Council. So, like, I think he's generally beloved by the players that play under him. I think that beyond that, there's just Craig Council seemed to have a deft touch. He seemed to have a feel for managing, and not that everything always worked out perfectly, but he had a pretty deft touch with making, especially like bullpen moves. And we don't know what that's going to look like under Murphy. And we don't know how much of it was Chris Hook. I mean, some of that really might have been a lot of Chris Hook's input, and that, you know, presumably isn't going to change because Chris Hook is still right there next to him. So we'll have to see. But yeah, that part of it is a concern too. I don't know how much you can bake something like that into playoff odds, but it gives me at least some pause to wonder where they're at this point. I guess I would, because James, you were pointing out, you were having a discussion in our group chat today about the fact that, so the guy who wrote this up for Baseball Prospectus was saying, yeah, Pecota says 79.4, I guess it was 79.2 when they ran it for that article, but he personally picked 84. And yeah. I feel like that kind of instinct, I get that, where you'd want to say, okay, I think they're actually a little bit better than these numbers just because they have
that guy,
so
by the
long.
Way, Daniel Epstein, just to give credit where it's
oh,
due.
Thank you. Thank yep, you. Sure. Yes. So yeah, I think that makes sense, but I don't know how heavily I want to rely on it. For those of you who are into the betting side of things, Easy was pointing out tonight on Twitter that the Vegas odds makers have him at 75.5. And I assume that's pricing in what they assume is going to be a Willy Adames trade, probably, right? Like, that seems likely what
probably.
That's doing.
Yeah. Probably, knock off another few WAR. Yeah,
but exactly. Yeah, I mean, if not, if that's just where Vegas has them, then yeah, I would pound that over all day because I think they are significantly better than 75.5 as the team stands today.
Well, so, I was going to ask, like you mentioned the high error bars and you mentioned you have some faith in the higher end, but what does the lower end error bar look like to you? You know, like if the projections are kind of aggregating around 79 to 81 wins, and this is where we put in the Fangraphs disclaimer that their win projections do not take into account schedule, so the weak ass NL Central does not factor into that 81.1. I guess, what's the floor look like for this team?
I think it's pretty low. Like, I think that they could, if things break wrong, very easily end up in the high 60s, low 70s as like a legit last place team. And I think the way that happens is pretty believable, just because they don't have Burns and, you know, to a lesser extent, Woodruff to lean on. Like, what if Peralta gets hurt, like, in the first 2 weeks of the season? Then you're cobbling together a really, really touchy pitching staff. You're going to wear out your bullpen a lot more quickly than you otherwise would. I think that's a big concern already. It's just that you're going to be like, they already lean on the bullpen more than anybody else does. And they used to get the occasional break from the occasional Burns actual good real pitcher start and the occasional Woodruff one. That's gone. Like, there's not like a giant one game innings eater on the team right now. So they're going to be leaning on that just a huge amount. If they lose any depth at starting pitching, that pitching staff could easily spiral into being pretty bad pretty quickly. And there's no guarantee they hit at all. They were not a good offensive team last year. They are a very, very young team, and there's every chance that they're going to be one of the worst offensive teams in baseball. So I think that that's kind of how you get to that floor. And while they have like a lot of like downstream depth, they're relying on a lot of guys just to keep things afloat too. So I think that's a very realistic scenario. I don't think it'll happen because it is a end of the spectrum scenario, but it's pretty plausible. Injuries do that to teams every once in a while.
Yeah, I think that for that to happen, like, there is a path to it. There's a path to high 60s, low 70s. That would be a lot of injuries piling up early and then them selling off at the deadline and just having a really bad August, September, where they have either guys who are hurt or they have guys who are no longer on the team, and then a bunch of young guys. Like, I could see that happening. I think it would require a lot of injuries, though, because this team is built around so much depth that I think it would require a lot. And it would also just require them, like, not to have like a hot month early in the season sometime, you know. They can't get off to, like, I think that scenario becomes very unlikely if they, you know, start off with like a really good April or something like that. That then just makes that really, really unlikely that it's going to end up happening. It is possible. I'm more positive on this team than you are, but like, I don't think by tons. That bottom end scenario, I think it would have to really play out just because of the depth being what it is. I think you'd really have to see it play out in a specific sort of sequence for that to work. And that would be the way it would happen. You know, if guys like Rhys Hoskins, Devin Williams, who am I for? Willy Adames, guys like that were to get traded because the team was out of it. Those guys go at the deadline. Yeah, I mean, you could see that really have a detrimental effect, one, on like the product of like the guys on the field, the players on the field, but also just like the psyche and the thing around the team where like you could see it just drag, where they're like, okay, this is bad. We're not contending. And you could see it just kind of drag that way. And that something like that happening could be a path for Pat Murphy to have a very short tenure as a Brewers manager. Like, that could lead to Murphy being out of here relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that's kind of the scenario too, where if you were to think of Murphy as the transitional manager, right? Like, yep. That was the kind of the idea that I had in the back of my head when they hired him. It's like, okay, so if they trade Burns and Adames, he sits there and takes the hit for a year, and then it's Ricky Weeks time next year. But we'll see. You know, all right, let's move on to other Patreon questions, because we do have a ton this week. Yeah. And we probably won't get to all of them, so we'll try to get through as many as possible. So Mark Podskarby asking, sort of related to the Gary Sanchez and Jacob Junis conversations we've had, does the fact that the Brewers reinvested most of the money they saved from the Burns trade into Junis and Sanchez change your opinion on the deal at all? I think, you know, for me, you kind of have to look at it like, what is it? Keith Law is always saying, you know, when you're trading a rental guy and the guy ends up re-signing, you cannot factor that into the evaluation of the trade, right? So I don't know if you can really factor that in, but how do you guys feel?
Yeah, so this one is interesting to me because I don't know whether to say this is reinvestment or not. Because on one hand, timing-wise, you would say, okay, they trade Burns And then immediately the week following of their trade of Burns, they go out and sign Junis and Gary Sanchez.
Spent $15 million.
Yes, and look at that. It's almost exactly the amount of money that they
right.
cleared yep. when they traded Burns. So from that perspective, there's like circumstantial evidence here that that's what they were doing. They were reinvesting this money and they were plowing it back into the team. On the other hand, this is the time of the year when the Brewers tend to do their investment. We've been calling for it. We've been saying now is the time from the time they signed Rhys Hoskins. Like, this is when the Brewers, if they're going to get active in the free agent market, this is when they do it, because this is when the prices have come down into sort of the wheelhouse that they want to go out and pay. So this is the time when normally they would spend. So I don't know exactly which way to look at it that way. I don't think it really changes my opinion of that trade. That trade is that trade based on what the guys do in that trade. That's going to be the important part. I don't think this part of it matters that much, because I don't know how much cause and effect there is here to begin with.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And you have to end up looking at how they spend in the aggregate, I think, to just make a determination on how they did. And yeah, they saved money by getting rid of Burns, but you know, but also he's going to be gone after a year. Yeah, you could resign him and all that stuff. Other concerns are there as well. And you got to look at it as a part of a bigger whole. Like, once we get to the start of the season, we can evaluate whether we think their level of spending and talent acquisition was actually appropriate. And maybe this will look kind of weird and bad in retrospect at that point, but maybe they do a few more things and it you know, makes more sense as a larger whole. And we, you know, we forever disconnect those things in our mind. So I think you had to evaluate them independently. And I think that there's still information to be gained before we pass judgment on it.
Yeah. Much like the Hader trade here, it's a situation where, yes, they saved money when they traded Corbin Burns. Obviously, there's $15 million they're not paying. When they traded Josh Hader, yes, they saved whatever the $2 or $3 million it was at the end of that year. And then they also saved the $11 million. But I don't think that's why they made those trades. They didn't do those trades to save that money. They would have been perfectly happy paying that player that money because that player was worth that money. That wasn't the issue. It was the fact that their time with the team was coming to an end because they weren't going to be re-signing them past that point. That's why they made those trades. So yes, you save the money and people get very touchy about that, but that wasn't why they make these moves. It's like a side part of these of the equation in these things. The driving reason is because of the time control aspect and trying to get something for those players while you still have them to help you in the future. It's not about trying to clear the payroll. Like, that's just like a side ancillary benefit to the whole thing.
All right. Well, speaking of adding players in that Corbin Burns trade, Jay Google's asking, just how big is run prevention this year? If Ortiz moves to third, I would imagine the Brewers are above average in defensive metrics, maybe not first base, especially with the Gold Glove nominee Christian Yelich. This could be an elite defensive team. So, you know, I think that would probably be pretty big, Paul, especially considering you're taking away from the quality of the pitching. You kind of need the defense to step up more.
Yeah, you do. And it probably will be. And that's not unusual for the Brewers to have. They usually do build their floor off of defense in particular, and have had a great one for a while. Adames is a great shortstop defensively. Ortiz is just a great infielder by all accounts. And their outfield should be phenomenal. Even if those guys aren't hitting, they should still be great. So yeah, it's huge. It's the strength of the team. One of the things I think you worry about with them a little bit is whether their pitching staff can actually keep the ball in the park enough to make that defense play up as much as it should. And I think one of the big potential weaknesses there, if they do start to get exposed a little bit depth wise, but yeah, like that's how this team is made to win. So it should be like the best defensive team in the league.
Yeah. It's, if not the best, it's right up there with the best. I think it's even better than last year's team, which was frankly phenomenal defensively mm-hmm. at most spots. Really the only negative spot Jay points it out is first base yep. Hoskins. But again, we talked about that you could potentially mitigate that going into the, like, if this team actually does make a playoff run and does something like that, you could potentially move Hoskins more over to the DH side and get, I don't know, Tyler Black or some, you know, random free agent. Maybe they bring back Carlos Santana for another go around. Who knows? Yeah. but they could bring in somebody else and have them play first base, then you've really probably got plus defense at every position on the diamond. And that really, like, that starts to compound and really will make the pitching look better than it is. And yes, I share Paul's concerns about the home run thing. That's the thing that can undo all this, is if you have one of those years where just balls are flying out of the park, we better really hope that MLB doesn't have any plans to juice the ball this year.
Yeah.
Because that could...
Not good for us.
Yeah, that could really derail things. We would be better off playing, a much tighter run prevention sort of situation.
That would definitely be the monkey's paw situation of, oh, mm-hmm. Christian Yelich hits for power, but the ball is juiced and Freddy Peralta gives up 40 home runs this year. That would not be great.
It would not.
All right. The next question is a little long, so apologies to Drew G, but we're going to kind of truncate it for the interest of not having to listen to me ramble for 10 minutes. So Drew's question here is, I would like to request a deeper look into Joey Ortiz. The defense first narrative is appropriate as he's an elite defender, but I think the high contact speed, lack of power description is potentially misguided and based on surface stats. The chase rate is alarming, but he's also only struck out at about 16% at AAA since 2022. So I would imagine he has not been too concerned with reining in the aggressiveness as he attempted to do more damage, and he maintained the huge contact rate while doing so. Drew then goes into a bunch of stats for Ortiz, William Adames, Matt McClain, and Noelvi Marte is sort of like a comparison there, and then compares him to some MLB players who have solid reps as power hitters. You guys can talk about this in your response, but basically the question here, or at least the prompt, is leaving defensive side, these are not what I would consider players lacking power. If anything, it's clear Ortiz could use a tweak to his bat path if he wants to put a few more balls over the fence. Obviously, he won't hit MLB pitching like he hits AAA, but I would not expect a drop in the max exit velocity of 5+ miles per hour, which is the gap between he and Adames and Matt McClain. All this to say, I think we should be cautiously very optimistic about the all-around ceiling of this kid, and pigeonholing him as a utility infielder already seems premature to me. I'd love to hear you guys entertain this conversation as a whole. So all of that said, Paul, Ryan, I guess, we kind of mentioned it that, Ortiz kind of does have some potential here that he started to realize in the last year or so in terms of power. It's just a question of whether or not you believe that's real and how much kind of potential is left there when he's 25.
Yeah, so looking first at kind of some Ortiz numbers that he pointed to, the average exit velocity is good, okay? 90.1, that's fine. You're talking about his in the 90th percentile in terms of max exit velocity. So he's doing well there, okay? So there's some positives there, and that does compare favorably to Adames and Matt McClain, though those numbers were put up in MLB, and Ortiz's numbers that were taken because he didn't have enough of an MLB sample, we're looking at AAA numbers, and you can't,
yep.
That is apples and oranges situation. We have to be careful about comparing Ortiz's AAA stats to Adames, McClain, whoever else, Tellez, Sawinski, Machado, Trout, Rosarena, Francisco Alvarez. We have to be careful about doing that because there is an apples and oranges comparison here, but he does seem to have some legitimate ability to make contact. He's right that the strikeout rate has been, I mentioned this on the pod last week with Steve, where we talked about the fact that his strikeout rate has been solidly below the league average, or better than the league average. Okay. So that's part of the good here. He is chasing a bit much. That is the concerning part of this, but the overall contact part of it, he's making the contact part seems to be fine. So all of that sort of adds up to say, I think there is some substantial, upside here for him to be able to at least hit the ball hard enough that he's going to impact, if not for big, he's not going to put up the big Willy Adames home run numbers. I definitely would not expect that. But I think in terms of being able to impact the ball and hit around the field, I think that he could very easily do. But we still have to see it at the big league level, because so far his big league career has been underwhelming. It's been a tiny sample, but it's been underwhelming. We still need to see it there. And really the biggest thing here is that his calling card is his defense. And if the offense can just sort of get up to that sort of league average for a shortstop, which means, a being, you know, kind of like 7, 8, 9, 10% below the league average, the park adjusted league average in terms of things like WRC plus and OPS plus, if he can do that, he's probably like a 2 to 3 win player right now. And Keith Law actually said that in his, Keith Law had him ranked, what was it, 51st, I think. Yeah. Law had him ranked 51st, and he said about him, he thinks he's like a 3-win player right now. And if that's the case, then yeah, the Brewers definitely really have something here, and that would probably really take the sting out of trading Willy Adames, though it would also take another bat out of the lineup.
Yeah, I think the thing about focusing on his defense is that's where his floor comes from. He is just a well-known quantity there. And in terms of his bat, he has a lot of raw power. It's just lots of guys have a lot of raw power. Turning it into functional power is the hard part. That bat path does need some work. It's hard to generate launch angle. Just look how difficult it's been to get Christian Yelich to elevate the damn baseball. Like, this does not happen right. Naturally. Mm-hmm. A ton of guys I've liked in the past have flamed out for this reason. Like, I used to like Matt Merton on the Cubs, who hit the ball very hard but directly into the ground for his entire career. Yes, that is his upside. If you project him to actually start elevating the ball and turn himself into like a 20-ish home run guy, he is incredibly valuable. But there's a long way to go before we get there. So we talk about what the known quantity is and wish on what he might be. But right now, he's a great defensive player with some upside out with the bat. But that's all he is.
Yeah, I think it's a really good shout. That 8.5 degree launch angle in AAA, I'd like to see that be like edging up towards the teens, please.
Yes, please.
Yeah, that's a little too yelly like for our taste.
It's not Yelich sure. territory, but it's veering dangerously in that direction.
No.
You like to see those double digit mm-hmm. launch rates. And we're not talking about getting up to Adames, which is like literally 18.2, which is really high. We were not talking about that, but like the Matt McClain 13.8, that would be perfectly cromulent. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah, no, 8.5 is where we get excited about Christian Yelich. So
yes.
Looking forward to that conversation again in June. All right. Cheese Cavaricci is our next question on Patreon this week, asking, I'm curious how the Brewers compare to other MLB clubs in terms of the prevalence of reverse platoon splits. Are there any other teams with a similar approach, and how do they fare from a competitive standpoint? Do you think the Brewers reverse platoon splits thing is intentional, and in what ways could that be some sort of strategic advantage or taking advantage of a market efficiency? I'm curious what the data says, because we are all well aware overall the Brewers' offensive production has been lacking for several years. I tend to trust that those running the team know what they're doing, but I'm skeptical of this approach. So, you know, I saw this and I was like, this seems like a perfect question for Paul and his Excel jujitsu.
Yeah.
How'd that go, Paul?
It went bad. Here's why it went bad. It's actually really hard to put. First of all, I managed to do this. The problem with doing it is that your sample size for one side of the platoon is often very small. Mm-hmm. And to capture all of it required an enormous data pull that StatHead does not actually make very easy. For numerous reasons that I won't complain completely about, but they leave out some important information. For instance, the team that the guy plays for, but that's not even
yeah.
Well, and also like some guys get traded during the season. Sometimes they play for two teams. Anyway, I did some jiggering. And what I found out is this: anybody with a high enough sample size to count in a giant report on platoon splits on the Brewers doesn't actually have reverse platoon splits, which I guess is its own insight. I got 10 guys last year with enough PAs to actually count. 9 of them had regular platoon splits, which wasn't even close to, you know, the biggest outlier. That's just a normal team. The Rockies had 6 guys with each. So they were the highest. But I do think they tend to get little fringe guys that do have this. And I'm not entirely sure what the strategic advantage is there. If I had to guess, and it's just a guess, it's that a lot of fringe guys who have big platoon splits often get signed by a lot of other teams to just play into those big platoon splits. And guys without them tend to actually be a little bit worse hitters. Like, you can't just use them and make them super good by protecting them against one side. I'm guessing they're a little more widely available, a little bit cheaper. And since the Brewers are willing to play third baseman at second base and do things like that, that they can get a little bit more value out of the leftovers there. But they also might see something profile-wise. They might not like platoon splits. They might like guys who can play against any pitcher. I don't know what to tell you. It might also just be noise, and noise is maybe the best answer.
Yeah, this one, because I posited that, I was like, okay, so does this mean that they just really focus on this on the fringes of the roster? And that maybe does seem to be the explanation, is that this is more their strategy here, is they go for the fringes of the roster and worry about it less generally. I don't know, man. This is a weird one. There is some positive utility to having right-handed hitters who are better against right-handed pitching than they are against left-handed pitching, because about 3/4 of the pitching in baseball is right-handed. So if you're a right-handed hitter, having some ability to do that. The problem is if you load up on too many of those guys, obviously, you start to struggle against lefties. And I think maybe that did play some role in their struggles with lefties over the past. Obviously, it wasn't this last year. Last year, this was not a problem. People thought it was, but it actually wasn't an issue. It was more of a problem in the previous years.
We get this. We got this really highlighted by Keston Hira too.
Yeah,
and it may just be one of those things where we notice it more because he was such a high profile reverse platoon split guy, where they wouldn't do it right. They wouldn't.
Yeah,
play
they
into
only
that.
Played him against lefties. Yeah, yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just interesting to, I guess, look at the data. But yeah, data can be noisy too. And maybe it is just the fringe guys, or maybe it is them, you know, Ryan, like you've said before, looking at the division and not seeing that many lefties. But, you know, yeah, if it's a strategy, it's an outside the box one. And I guess we'll just continue to immediately go to the splits page of anybody else that they signed, because that's my number one thing to do now. All right. Nick Vollendorf asking, when the Brewers acquired Ortiz and Hall in the Burns trade, they had to clear a 40-man roster spot. To do that, they DFA'd Ethan Small. I was surprised to see that he was out of options. Did the Brewers really have to DFA Small, or could they have just outrighted him to Nashville? My impression is you are all not fans of Small and are probably happy to see him gone. Please elaborate. Sorry if this is old news, but I never saw much about this aspect of the Burns trade. They did kind of fly under the radar. Another, I guess, if you want to, you know, be critical, another first round pick failure in some lights. Ryan, you know, like, could they have gotten away with sneaking him through and trying to outright him? Or do you think that first round pedigree, somebody would have taken a chance on him even as a reliever? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think somebody is going to. I think the fact that he went to San Francisco is no accident. They are a team that does good things with pitchers. They got a lot out of Jacob Junis. I expect they're going to do some things with Ethan Small, maybe get more out of him than we were able to get out of him. So that'll be interesting. One thing I do want to clear up, he wasn't out of options. He still has an option year left this year. The issue was is that he was taking up a spot on the 40-man, and they wanted to... Basically, they at this point didn't view him well enough. And somebody asked me about this on Twitter earlier this week, and it was like, well... You know, not every draft pick is going to hit. And Ethan Small was always sort of a weird pick in that he was drafted for very specific reasons, in that they saw the spin, they saw the characteristics, and they thought he would really play up. But most people had him as like a 50th overall pick, something in that range, like a mid-second rounder. And the Brewers popped him at 28. Now, 28 is not real early in the draft. It's not, you know, especially when it's your first draft pick. And you don't necessarily have some other money that you can like shuffle around. It was a pretty tough situation. Okay. So that is going to happen. Not every draft pick is going to be a big success. And Ethan Small wasn't. But I still think for a guy who strikes out what he does from the left-handed side, even if it's just in the bullpen, even if he's just doing this out of as a reliever, I think that there is some significant potential here for a turnaround, and at least being a decent reliever for a while as a lefty who I was trying to stall here and vamp while I got the strikeout rate, and it was in AAA last year, he was striking out 28.5% of batters. That's really pretty good. So there's a reason you would want to keep that guy around and see if you can mold him into something a little bit more useful than what Ethan Small has been.
Just couldn't ever really get the control, you know, under control, I guess. So that was the downfall there. But yeah, you know, the Giants have done wonders with a lot of people like that who had great spin, great stuff, and just couldn't put it all together. And, you know, so best of luck to him in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm. And knowing what I know about his politics, have fun. Have fun with that, buddy.
Just such a horrible city to live in. Price Trozen asking, I was trying to think of a Bobby Witt deal versus Trujillo deal question, but I can't get the phrasing right. So instead, I'm going to ask what you guys think of how Thiago Vieira will do this season and what his role will be. What do we think of Thiago Vieira, other than that it's an 80 grade name for sure?
Yeah, I was really impressed with what I saw. He looked like he had some really nasty, legitimate major league stuff in the very brief amount of time we saw him at the end of last year. And it really was just a very, very, very short time period. But he looked like he could potentially pitch meaningful innings out of the bullpen. And he's kind of been around for a while. He's a 30-year-old. He's not like a young guy, but I liked what I saw stuff-wise out of him. Again, it was three innings, so you can't really draw much of a conclusion. But the fact that he elected to come back to the Brewers because they had released him and he came back says something to me about what, you know, potentially you got going on there.
You're going to need a lot of arms like that to get 27 outs, right, Paul?
Ryan's seen three more innings of him than I have, so...
easy to miss those.
Seems fine.
Yeah, I did want to go back real quick because the first part of his thing, he was talking about the Bobby Witt deal and the Trujillo thing.
Yeah.
And that does, it brought up a lot of discussion. But one of the things that's interesting about that is it does make the point that this is why the Brewers did the Trujillo deal when they did. Because if you don't do the deal when they did it, the Bobby Witt deal is what you end up with, is you end up paying. You know, what they're going to end up with is they're putting three times as much out there potentially for Witt over about the same time period. It's 11 seasons in Witt's case and 10 seasons in Churio's case. So you're putting out quite a bit more money because of that. So this is sort of the gamble that the Brewers are making, is they're betting on Churio to be good, having not seen him at the big league level, because if you don't do that, you end up doing what the Royals did with Bobby Witt, which was having to pay substantially more than that.
Yep. They're taking a risk to get a good deal.
Yep.
That's it.
Yeah. Yep. And it's a gamble.
Avoiding all the player options on top of that too. That Bobby Witt deal is just fascinating to look at.
Yeah. Right. I do wonder about that part of the Bobby Witt deal, because it's literally $140 million that the Royals will only pay Bobby Witt if he isn't good enough to opt out. So that $140 million on the back end of that deal is literally, that's just, they only pay that if he is, I want to say bad, but not good enough to opt out. So basically, if the deal is somehow underwater, that's when you get stuck with it. And that's, man, it's a lot for a team that is, you know, doing $35 million a year for 4 years, for a team whose payrolls have been in the, you know, currently in the 100 and, well, mostly under 100 lately, but they're edging up over 100 at this point. It's a lot of money. And so there's some substantial risk in doing that. Bobby Witt is fantastic, so I doubt that it ends up working out that way, but guys do get hurt. That would be my big fear, is like Bobby Witt breaks an ankle and I would just, at that point, things could get really ugly if that just, you know, something like that were to happen and were to sap his just overall athleticism and whatever. But yeah, he was a 6-win player as what, a 21-year-old last year. He's on a very, very good path.
Yeah. And I just appreciate that a team looking to get a new stadium paid for extended somebody in the process. So, all right. Miley Lemonade. Asking, updated Zips projections currently show Wes Clark, who has never been above double A, to see over 500 plate appearances, over 118 games, and hit 20 home runs. There's your mystery power, I guess. A few other double A players also seem to have some very inflated MLB projections. Is this a sign that Zips doesn't know how to interpret the current roster? Paul, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't think that there's really a nice way to answer that. I don't even really understand the inner workings of how the projection systems go about that, because projection systems are famously bad at projecting how minor league players who are still quite far away from the majors are going to do in the first place. And there's a lot of speculation. Like, they project them as to how they would do if they were up at the majors very often. That's how the projection works. Not often, not always, but they're always really bad. Stuff like that is somewhat nonsensical. I think a lot of time it's based on age and platoons and things like that. But yeah, I think that's just a weird, random, bizarre thing that happens with projection systems once in a while, and you should ignore it. And I do think maybe Prospectus has a few weird ones here and there too, but I think they're a little more conservative with stuff like that and do go back and fix those problems a little bit more often.
So this is where depth charts is very helpful. Go over to the depth charts page on FanGraphs and look at what the Brewers are. So this is roster resource, basically filtering through and projecting using zips what's going to happen here. And they don't have him getting any plate appearances in the big league level. They have Rhys Hoskins with 511, Jake Bowers with 147, Tyler Black with 28 at first base, Owen Miller with 14 at first base, which we don't need to see that again. I've seen that show. That I've walked out on that show. But yeah, they don't have Wes Clark getting any here. And that's the important thing to understand, is they're not really expecting him to get this time. And I wouldn't either. There is some off chance that Wes Clark could have, you know, a big league career for some time, but that profile, the right-handed first baseman, all power, no any other like skills, and by the way, massive strikeout rate, absolutely massive strikeout rate. That profile does not tend to migrate to the big leagues well at all. So it's perfectly wonderful having a guy like that around. He might even manage to do something in his big league career and have a big league career, I guess I should say, but you don't expect anything there. Okay. Anything you get is gravy.
All right. Last Patreon question we'll get to this week comes from Tricky Henderson, who's asking, I see you have a plethora of thoughtful questions, a swell thing for February, and a sign I have excellent taste in podcasts. To ensure greater brevity in the Q&A flow, I ask simply, assuming Gary Sanchez was a verb rather than a proper noun, what would that particular action be? For comparative purposes, the Sal Frelick is a rare high-risk maneuver best left to contortionists and tightrope walkers. Keep doing what you all do. It makes Brewer baseball more fun. Peace. So I guess, Paul, what would to Gary Sanchez be?
To Gary Sanchez would be to cook a food item that everybody thinks is mediocre in one capacity, but is shockingly good in a less appreciated capacity.
There we go. I guess that works. I could see it.
Wow.
Ryan, what do you think?
There's just no way I can compete with that. I have no idea why this popped into my head. But you know, when back in the 20s and 30s, when they were building those big, big buildings, there was a guy whose job was, they would be taking the rivets that they were about to put into like building the buildings. They would heat them up, and then they would have to toss them to the person who's actually going to take them and put them into the thing to hold the pieces of metal together. And there was a guy who literally held a cup, and it had like a metal funnel, and it was to catch the heated rivet. That would be that is to Gary Sanchez, is to catch the hot rivet in that little cup. And then to hand it over. And I have no idea why that popped into my head. It was completely random.
That is the most random thing I've heard in a very long time. Yep.
Very extremely random. And I don't know why it came in, because I haven't seen a documentary or anything with that in it in ages. But for some reason, that's what popped into my head. I think
I
it's Gary.
Ask,
I think
how
it's
do you even know that? Like, it's how, the, it's the how Gary are you thing. An expert in 1920s building techniques?
Okay, so I did, I don't know, a couple months ago, maybe it was over Christmas, I watched a thing about the building of the Empire State Building. So that's, I think that's probably where it came from, was the dance that they had to do to be able to toss those things around. And the fact that they were actually pulling, well, I'm just going to give all of the 1920s metallurgy stuff here. They were actually taking girders and things off the line in Pittsburgh and bringing them to New York so fast that they were going into the building still warm. So they were building with those metal girders still warm off the presses or whatever it is in Pittsburgh. Like 20 hours later, they would be rendering them and then putting them into the building still warm.
Well, damn. I learned something. So there you go, Tricky. Hopefully that satiates your desire for some extra info here and further reinforces your excellent taste in podcasts. Where else are you going to hear a ton of analysis on the Gary Sanchez acquisition and learn something about how the Empire State Building was built? So taking it back to New York, too. I like that as well. All right. That'll do it for the questions we can get to this week. As we noted, we had a lot and couldn't get to them all without doing like 2 hours this week. So we are going to take those and use them maybe next week or in a week or two, you know, depending on how the news flow goes. As a reminder, you sign up to become a patron at patreon.com/MKETailgate. You get question priority every week. We will eventually get to your question, we promise. Also, when you sign up, we get a shout out on this podcast from Ryan. So, Ryan, who do we have joining us or at least upgrading this week?
Yeah, we actually had a couple upgrades this week. So, and this is all to offset. We lost our. We're still in the process of losing people during the winter months of the RAE season. So
the winter is cold and unforgiving. Yes,
the winter is cold and unforgiving. But thank you to Drew G, who asked that question, and thank you for being a good sport about the cutting down of that, because we had to do some trimming there to make it fit for air. Matthew LeGrave also joined new this week. And then we also had a couple of upgrades, as you mentioned. Matthew Heggie upgraded to Ball and Glove from the Barrelman level, also upgrading from Barrelman to Ball and Glove, meaning they get all that extra content now, was Eric Roll. So thank you to all of you for doing that. We greatly appreciate it. It makes this whole thing, you know, it's that little extra spice that makes this existence extra nice.
Appreciate it as always. That'll do it for us this week. You know, we're getting close to pitchers and catchers reporting, so hopefully we'll have some, you know, grainy pictures of guys starting to throw things, and we'll start learning about who's learning, you know, sweepers and cutters and all that fun stuff. That'll do it. We'll pack things up here. See you guys then. Hope everyone has a good week, and we will see you next time on Milwaukee's Tailgate.
Fair weather.